please the court. Good morning. This case involving the Civil Service Act presents three issues to the court. First, whether the omission of the required notice provided under 143.057J deprives the hearing examiner of jurisdiction. Secondly, if the statute is a jurisdictional requirement, whether substantial compliance or strict compliance is required. And finally, whether or not the statute allows the award of attorney's fees with respect to an appeal involving a hearing examiner. As a threshold issue, with respect to this notice requirement in the Texas Local Government Code, the issue before the court is whether or not it's jurisdictional in nature. And the Fifth Court of Appeals, in holding that it was, relied on its own precedent that had been handed down from 1991 and 1985 without fully analyzing the court's refinement of this type of issue provided in the Dubai versus Kazi case and its progeny from 2000 until as recent as May of 2008. Under the Dubai analysis, the requirement in the notice letter provided by the police department is not jurisdictional in nature. Rather, it is procedural in nature, does not divest the hearing examiner of jurisdiction at all. In Dubai, the court found that when analyzing statutory requirements like this, we had to look toward a reasonable outcome and consider several factors. The first issue is whether or not the statute actually states that it's jurisdictional in nature. Here you'll find this provision of the Civil Service Act makes no reference whatsoever to this notice element being a jurisdictional requirement. So that takes us into the factors that have been laid forth by this court.
First, if it's not jurisdictional, what's the penalty for not complying?
The remedy for that would be taken under consideration by the hearing examiner, just simply because...
What if it didn't come up before the hearing examiner ruled?
Well, in that case, Your Honor, I think it probably would be waived. The election before the hearing examiner is very narrow with respect to the issues that can be appealed. The appealable issues are mainly jurisdictional. There's another element dealing with fraud and that type of thing, but we mainly see jurisdictional appeals, which
seems
is why.
Like it seemed like it might come up a lot after the hearing examiner ruled. Get an adverse ruling, okay, now what do? Oh, I can appeal. No, I can't appeal. Maybe that's the first time anybody's noticed it.
Even in that case, the remedy would be abatement. It would not be to completely throw out any type of review of the disciplinary action whatsoever.
Abatement. What do you mean by abatement?
Abatement, perhaps an opportunity to cure, a suspension. In this case, the hearing examiner offered to allow the officer to make an election, another election, to go back and elect before the commission.
Because the issue came up before the hearing started.
It did. It did, and that would have been a proper remedy. And there have been remedies like that that have been applied. Further, if it did come up before the hearing examiner, another remedy would be simply that the examiner could consider the procedural application and whether or not the city had properly done what it was supposed to do in his or her application of the remedy.
Consider how? I mean, how would that impact the hearing examiner's decision?
Well, the hearing examiner could decide whether or not the city fully complied or properly complied.
And if it did not, then what's the remedy?
He or she could potentially invalidate the discipline based on the facts below. Here we know that the officer did have actual notice of his appellate remedies or the narrowing down of his appellate remedies. We also know he had an attorney at the time of his election. So in this case, there may not be the type of harm that the hearing examiner would analyze. That would be up to the examiner.
But we don't want to. I mean, who brought this up? They did when they objected, right?
That is correct.
And we don't want to jump from the frying pan into the fire. It sounds to me like you're suggesting if we rule the way you want, then what they should have done is kept silent, had the whole hearing, and then they could have thrown it out and started all over. I mean,
no, Your Honor, that's absolutely not what I'm suggesting. What I'm
Didn't you just say if they brought it up for the first time after the hearing, they can validate the whole thing?
No, sir. If I said that, then I apologize. Let me clarify what I intended to present to the court, and that is that if the officer brings up this issue before the hearing examiner could consider it in making his or her determination. meaning the hearing examiner could consider whether or not the officer received all of the notice that he was entitled to and whether or not the city properly did what it was supposed to do in disciplining the officer. So that would be to the officer's benefit in that case, not to his detriment. To construe this requirement as jurisdictional.
But if they raise it for the first time, hearing's done, they get an adverse decision, they come to appeal, then what happens if for the first time it's raised, but they've waived it?
Well, let me clarify that with respect to appeals of hearing examiner's decision under the Civil Service Act, there is still some lack of clarity. I think the court actually is considering another case that deals with that very issue with respect to what the confines of the appeal are and interpreting the statute along those lines. So that area is a bit unclear. One suggestion that I would make is that the court could remand it back to the hearing examiner and allow an opportunity to cure the provision or allow another election before the commission once there's time. You know, the remedies, while they're not clear, they're not spelled out in the statute, and while the court may have a better idea of a remedy than what I'm proposing,
well, when under Section G, when would a arbitration panel be without jurisdiction or exceed its jurisdiction?
Under Section G?
J.
Oh. The provision in question.
You appeal to the hearing examiner's award to the district court, and the district court only considers whether the arbitration panel was without jurisdiction or it's exceeded its jurisdiction.
One situation,
when would it do either one of those?
One situation would fall with respect to a notice requirement that is set forth in 143.052F. And just to make sure I'm clear when I'm throwing out these numbers before the court, that statute is what gives the notice requirements. Then over in the section that Justice Brister, you just mentioned, it adds the additional requirement that's at issue in this case. Back under 143.052, notice requirements also include that the department in this notice letter fully set forth in a case of suspension, which we had here, a serious case, the facts and allegations against the officer. But in 143.052F, there is a provision, there is a remedy here that divests jurisdiction because it states that if the department head does not specifically point out in the written statement, the notice, the acts of the firefighter or police officer that allegedly violated the civil service rules, the commission shall promptly reinstate the person. So I would submit that if this jurisdictional, this substantive notice requirement is not met, that it could divest.
Back to Judge Heck's hypothetical. The guy or gal doesn't know they're not going to be able to appeal. Nobody tells them, it's not in the notice. They go to the hearing examiner. They think the hearing examiner gets it all wrong, and they file appeal, and they go to district court. And the district court, they start giving the reasons why it's all wrong. The district court says, don't want to hear it. You can't appeal on any of those. Now the firefighter says, but nobody told me that. And if that's right, and that's they weren't told that, and it's kind of unfair, and the only way you can reverse it is on grounds that they were without jurisdiction, doesn't that need to be something that takes away their jurisdiction?
I think what needs to happen is that, or what I would suggest needs to happen, is that the court needs to define what the appropriate remedy would be, because the statute is silent, as the court has done in other cases applying the Dubai progeny. Here's the problem.
But if it's procedural, your argument is it's procedural,
yes,
not
sir.
Jurisdiction.
That's correct.
The district court couldn't do a single thing about it.
The guy
would just be out of luck.
Well.
Because it wouldn't be by fraud, collusion.
Right.
The only other grounds is without jurisdiction.
The problem here is that the statute is silent as to the remedy. And even though the statute's silent as to the remedy, I don't believe that it excludes a remedy at some at some level. Under Dubai, one of the main requirements of the court considered and has considered since Dubai is whether or not there is a just and reasonable result that meets the purpose of the statute, or whether or not the result is absurd. So I certainly agree that in the hypothetical presented by you, Justice Brister, that sounds unfair. However, I think what the court has to focus on is, first of all, it's not what happened here. Here we had a situation that was different, so the facts are distinguishable. But second, when looking at the purpose of this statute, which is to provide for police officers who are not subject to political influence and to provide for competent police officers, that the court's held that you have to look at the public versus the individual factors if it gets down to that point.
How are we to read or treat Dubai in light of, as Officer White points out, this post-Dubai change to the Code Construction Act?
Well, the Code Construction Act in Section 311.034 applied specifically to a waiver of immunity in suits against a governmental entity, which is not at issue here. And if you look at the court's May 2008 decision in Eagle versus Bright Star, you'll see that the court also in that case found that wasn't applicable and it wasn't to be considered. And I would submit that's the same here with the case at bar. To interpret this statute, statutory notice requirement being jurisdictional, would mean that in this case and many other cases across the board where a non-lawyer, we're not talking about a criminal prosecutor, chiefs of police, fire chiefs, fail to include one provision, a couple of words, in this case a sentence.
Well, it's an important provision. Let's not diminish the importance of the provision. But I suppose we could posit a lot of unfair scenarios. I mean, if it were jurisdictional, then someone who'd been suspended for 10 years could then come back in and say, wait a minute, you didn't give me that notice and be reinstated, couldn't they?
That's exactly right, Justice O'Neill. All of those determinations would be subject to being void if there's no jurisdiction, because jurisdiction is an argument that is not waived. That's an excellent point, and that's the point the court has carried throughout the Dubai progeny. In addition to that, you would find that these disciplinary matters would never receive any kind of review whatsoever. It would simply be, well, the department didn't meet the black letter of the law, so let's kick it out. That doesn't meet the purpose of the statute, and it doesn't meet the public interest of having officers who are capable be on their police forces. In this case, the Court of Appeals ordered that the department reinstate the officer, remove all issues or all mentions regarding this issue from his record, despite the fact that he'd been found both by the department and by a very competent hearing examiner to be an officer without integrity who had violated portions of the Department and Civil Service Act requirements. That certainly does not further the purpose of the Civil Service Act, nor does it further public interests in having officers with integrity and a high level of competency on the streets.
This 5-day notice provision also procedural?
I'm so sorry, Your Honor. I can't hear you.
The 120-day notice, is that also procedural?
You know, that's an interesting question. And it has not been determined. I would submit that it may be. One thing I find very interesting about this court's recent decision in the Eagle case is that it looks at an administrative jurisdictional document, which in this case would be a notice of appeal, and says that the time requirements there are procedural and not substantive. You know, so I would be interested to see if that issue came up, how the court interpreted it.
How about if B says the firefighter's got to submit a written request along with the notice of appeal if you want to go to the hearing examiner?
Mm-hmm.
What if you do the written request a day after the notice of appeal? Is that jurisdictional?
Before I read the Agaw case, I would have submitted that it probably was, simply based on a long series of case law from different courts of appeals holding that the notice of appeal that the officer has to file is jurisdictional in nature and is substantive in nature. And even one court held that even being 1 hour past a 10-day requirement, and it was out, there was no jurisdiction. In light of this court's decision recently in Eagle, I'd be interested to see how this court would apply it to that case. It may very well be
looking
this court
for help,
to be procedural.
Not interest.
I certainly think that if the court finds the same statutory impetus here that it did in that case, that the court very well may find that. I certainly believe what I'm arguing to the court today, what I believe is right under the law, and what I submit is that the Dubai analysis applies here. And if the court extends that even to a jurisdictional notice of appeal, then it would apply to both sides equally. Certainly the San Antonio court thinks that it does. Thank you.
Thank you, Counselor. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Dubrava will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. There are four reasons why this provision should be jurisdictional. First, if it's not jurisdictional, then we're going to turn a mandatory provision that's clearly mandatory into a non-mandatory provision, because the hearing examiner can ignore that mandatory provision and his decision is not reviewable on appeal. This will render both the appellate remedy and the mandatory provision meaningless and ineffective. Second, the jurisdictional nature of this provision is further illustrated by 143.052H, which expressly prohibits the department head from disciplining an officer if required notice is not given within a certain time period. Three, this case is easily distinguishable from this court's opinion in Dubai versus Casey, because a hearing examiner is a court of extremely limited jurisdiction. I don't believe you have the same concern with regard to finality of judgments. And you have a statutory provision that's easy to determine whether or not it was complied with. And four, I believe if we have some prior precedent, the City of Temple Fireman and Policeman Civil Service Commission versus Bender decided in 1990. I think if this court were to determine that this particular provision is not jurisdiction, that would effectively overrule the decision in Bender.
Is it true that in this case the officer had the opportunity to withdraw his election and the whole issue was discussed before the hearing started?
Well, actually, that's an illusory statement there, because under previous Supreme Court opinions, specifically Bender, the officer had – it was jurisdictional. The officer had to have filed his appeal with the commission within 10 days. So if they're making an offer now at the hearing examiner within 10 days of the – notice of disciplinary action. That's what that decision ruled. So if now we're before the hearing examiner and all of a sudden the city comes in and say, okay, we'll let you appeal and change your mind and go over to the Civil Service Commission, well, he didn't have that option under existing case law at that point in time. Because the time had run. And in addition, I think that the city never even attempted to comply with the statute. They never issued any type of notice. They came into the hearing and said, we'll give you an opportunity to go over to the Civil Service Commission, but they never tried to amend the notice or anything else. There is no attempt at a compliance, let alone substantial compliance.
There wasn't any mistake at that point that those options existed.
At the time of the hearing, I believe the officer did know that those options existed because...
So the city's attempted compliance at that point would have been rather meaningless, wouldn't it?
Yes, just like it's meaningless for the officer to have received at that point, because he couldn't have gone over to the Civil Service Commission. He had lost that right. He didn't have the ability to do that from this court's opinion in Bender. In Dubai, this court put forth this right to go forward approach and as a means of making sure a mandatory provision was still enforced and could be reviewed on appeal. Well, we can't apply that approach here, because even if the hearing examiner takes a look at this in terms of a right to go forward issue, it's not appealable. It's not jurisdictional, then the district court can't hear it. And I think that's where you look at this overall statutory scheme. If the legislature is going to mandate something that happens, then to turn around and say that it's not appealable, that is, there's no way to make sure that legislative mandate is enforced, that doesn't...
Well, we've addressed that lots of times. Okay. I mean, starting with Hash versus Hines, DT said you got to send a DTPA notice, whatever it was, 75 days before you file suit. And the argument is, and if you don't, you lose all your rights. But as we held, if the statute doesn't say, and if you don't do it, you lose all your rights, then we look at what the purpose was, and we ended up in that case saying it's an abatement. There's nothing in here that says, and if they don't have this notice in the letter, the guy gets reinstated and the department's out of luck.
You're right. There's nothing in the statute that
says that. So if the purposes of that is just to give him notice, which it clearly is, then why isn't that just like the Hines versus Hash DTPA notice letter? If he already knew it, then no harm, no foul.
Well, because if he knows it, but he knows it 10 days after he receives a disciplinary action, it doesn't give him any, doesn't help him, because it's jurisdictional.
He was represented within 10 days.
I'm assuming
so. He was represented in the department.
I'm assuming so in this case, but that doesn't mean that the attorney even knew that that was correct within 10 days. I mean, you look at this court's decision in Bender, and the attorney didn't know that he had to provide specific information in his notice of appeal. And
just by way of background on this process, why do officers normally want to go to the hearing examiner or not? And if what
drives part of that, I mean, from normal situation, is cost is one thing. It depends on how much they're going to, you know, if they're going to have to pay for part of the fee for the arbitrator. If they go to the Civil Service Commission, there's no fee that they have to pay. Another issue is the appeal issue. If you're looking at a legal issue that's going to be, you think you have a good, strong legal issue, you may want to go before the Civil Service Commission because it's reviewable on appeal, that particular legal issue. Or otherwise, you probably want to go before a hearing examiner. So those are basically the factors that come into consideration for that. I just want to make reference in 143.052H. It says that the department head may not complain of an act if the required notice is not given within 180 days. In this court's opinion in Houston versus Clark from 2006, it analyzes, had some bill analysis included in there for this particular notice provision on the limited jurisdiction of a hearing examiner. And the bill analysis that's described in that case says that that provision is described as adding requirements to the content of the letter of disciplinary action. So it's adding contents to this notice letter that the police chief has to give them. It's clear that if that notice is not given within 180 days, the police chief cannot complain about any act beyond that. Makes it clear. What we're looking at, this is akin to exhaustion cases, really, when you're looking at the question as to what entity is the proper authority to hear the dispute. The chief of police must first make an initial decision and comply with the statute before anything else can go forward. That is the proper entity that has to give this notice, that has to and must do so within 180 days. I believe that also supports the jurisdictional nature of this provision. With regard to Dubai, I guess I want to bring up one of the issues in Dubai is that we had this court of general jurisdiction, our state district court, and we overturned Mingus and say we're not going to presume that the district court does not have jurisdiction. We're going to presume that a court of general jurisdiction, the district court, has jurisdiction, and then see if there's indications that it should not be there. Well, here we have a hearing examiner, a court specifically created by statute, and there's a long line of cases saying in this situation, in administrative agency situations, we're not going to presume that you have general jurisdiction. We're going to presume basically the opposite and start from that approach. And this is in line with well-established Supreme Court precedent in the area of the civil service rules, and that's City of Sherman versus Arnold from 1950 and Bishop versus Carver from 1959, both of which stated that the full performance of all conditions precedent to the civil service laws is an essential prerequisite to the jurisdiction of the removing body over the subject of the removal of an officer. Next concern I'm going to address is the lack of finality of judgments. I don't think you'll be able to challenge the hearing examiner's jurisdiction, you know, a year down the road or 10 years down the road, because I think that challenge has been prescribed by the statute. It may be jurisdictional in nature, and it's jurisdictional of an administrative type court, but the statute says your remedy is limited to an appeal to the district court. So we can't come in and challenge this 2 years down the road. And in fact, I think the appeal timeline that all the officers across the state comply with is set forth in 143.015, because it provides a 10-day deadline from which to appeal to district court.
That's true of all jurisdictional defects. You could have appealed them. I mean, that's the funny thing about subject matters jurisdiction. You certainly could have raised it at the time and had a right to appeal and say there's no jurisdiction, kick it out, but you don't have to. You can wait 20 years and then say, and I agree with you, it says you can appeal if they were without jurisdiction, but if it's subject matter jurisdiction, it doesn't matter that they don't.
In the administrative agency context, I believe there are a number of cases, and I have to get the court with those sites, that discuss kind of that issue. And that is, if you have an agency and then you don't file your appeal from that, but then you sue them to say they didn't have authority to do that, that this court has held you have to go through that process first. Once you have to file your, if you miss your 30-day appeal deadline to appeal from the administrative agency to district court, and then you go to sue to challenge that.
Well, the way you do it is a collateral attack. You just keep showing up for work and taking your salary and make the agency do something about it, and then you collaterally attack it and say they had no jurisdiction.
They're not going to pay you while you're there. He's already gone. He's out. He's kicked the door. They've taken his badge, his gun, his shield, everything that he has, and he doesn't have the opportunity to really come back in.
But I'm troubled.
At that point.
But I mean, you're arguing that everything in administrative agencies do isn't subject to the normal subject matter jurisdictional rules.
I think if you go through the process, I think that I'd have to go back and.
You just said
right.
It.
Yeah, I think if you go through the process and you don't file your appeal within the 30 days, yes.
Well, then that sounds like something other than subject matter jurisdiction.
I think it is, and I think what we're looking at here is a different type of subject matter jurisdiction when you're talking about this type of court versus our common law courts or our constitutional courts that we have. It's a different type of jurisdictional issue. It's just basically the question of, do they have authority? And under the statute, do this person have authority? And if they don't, we get to challenge it in a direct appeal. We don't get to challenge it 2 years later.
Let me back you up under 143.057, the notice. If it's not timely provided, then you say the only remedy that the statutory scheme allows for in order to enforce that and keep it mandatory is that there be no jurisdiction because it can't be reviewed by the district court.
Right.
So you're searching for a remedy, and sounds like the only way to have a remedy to enforce this mandatory provision is to say there's no jurisdiction if it's not complied with. That kind of is a different approach to a no jurisdictional argument than we've heard before. Have we ever held that in order to have a remedy, we've got to find that there's no jurisdiction for the mandatory provision? Normally we look at it kind of on a different approach. Either there's jurisdiction to do it or not. Not what's the remedy. The only way to have a remedy is to hold there's no jurisdiction. So conceptually, have we done it that way before on a jurisdictional issue?
Not putting it in those words. I think you've done it in terms of looking at what the legislative intent is and trying to make sure we enforce the statutorily mandated provisions. I mean, here, if the legislature is going to mandate, there's a whole bunch of mandates. There are like five different mandates that use the word must for this notice provision. So if they're going to mandate that, and there's no way to make sure, there's got to, the overall scheme in looking at this, you think they're going to want to have some way to make sure that their mandate is complied with. Just if you're going to make a meaningful, reasonable interpretation of that. And the only way to make sure that their mandates in this statute are complied with is if the provision is jurisdictional. Because of the limited appeal to district court.
Are you familiar with any cases where we've taken that approach before?
Not that specific approach. I think I've seen other cases where you look at the overall statutory scheme in terms of determining the intent of the provision.
No, but the effect is if we had a police officer who did something terrible and they kick him out of the police department and the letter doesn't have this, everything's done fine except we didn't tell him that, by the way, if you go to the hearing examiner, you can't appeal. Then if you don't tell him that, it's all dismissed and he must be reinstated and go back to work. That's what the legislature intended.
I don't know. I can't address on that particular issue except.
But I mean, that's the problem. That's the problem with what you're saying. What if, I mean, the police, you know, whatever these guys did in Athens, a police officer shoots a teenager and there's rioting in the streets, and because we left a sentence out of the letter informing of a right that he may have already known about from his lawyer anyway, then the only thing we can do is order him reinstated full pay.
Well, you got two things going there. One is if you allow the city, which currently I don't believe that the city is allowed to do this, is the city can't the statute, there's another provision of the statute that says that the department head cannot amend his notice of discipline. Okay? And this court in Bishop versus Carver determined that that was mandatory and jurisdictional, basically. Could not file a subsequent amendment. And you look at the overall scheme here is we have officers, and the reason why we have the civil service provision is I see it daily, is that officers go to make an arrest. They arrest somebody who's the son of a council member, son of the mayor, friend of somebody who's politically connected. All of a sudden, they get in trouble. They start taking heat from, they're told to change the arrest report, put it in another file, do whatever they do or you're going to get fired. And the civil service statute was designed to protect against that. If you give the leeway to these cities and you give the leeway to the head of these police chiefs and make some gray areas, that provides them with the opportunity to harass an officer.
Well, I'm against all of that. I'm against all that. But I gather from what you're saying the answer to my question about the case where there's a bad, really bad police officer and there's rioting in the streets because of what he or she did, the only... Because you left a sentence out, it's a mandatory reinstatement. Your answer is yes.
Yes, they have to be reinstated, and it's just like how. What other enforcement mechanism do you have? It's we look in the criminal law area, and in the Miranda cases where you're trying to you exclude a lot of evidence. You exclude evidence that of somebody who's clearly guilty because you're trying to enforce a particular important provision of, in that case, the U.S. Constitution, and in this case, this statute.
Okay, so the city messes up there. And the officer has to be reinstated, full back pay, and so forth. Is the city then entitled to go back and restart the process, or is it over?
See, that's where, and personally, that's where I think the problem is with everything here. Under Bishop versus Carver, the answer would be no. Okay, but if this court were to go back and look at Bishop v. Carver, I think the answer could be completely different. Because, I mean, under Bishop v. Carver, what you had was...
Was that us or somebody else?
That was a long... That was 1959.
Us or somebody
else? No, that was somebody... That was the Texas Supreme Court.
Okay.
1959. That's exactly what the chief tried to do. He gave a notice and then was pointed out it was defective. And then after the 10 days, not much after the 10 days, he went ahead and reinstated the officer, gave him back pay, so just as if he was still had been employed that whole time, and then reissued the notice to go forward. And the court back in 1959 held that you couldn't do that. So that's kind of the situation.
Same statute, same
sentence. Same statute, same everything. And then look, that's where it kind of brings us to this.
One other thing before you go on. Do I understand you to say then that if under circumstances that happen just like this, except for the fact that nobody raised the question at the hearing examiner level, and the examiner affirmed the chief's decision and so forth, and then 10 years later, you couldn't come back and upset that?
That would be my opinion. And that would be because we have it's a different type of jurisdictional issue here than I think we're talking about with our constitutional courts, and it's statutorily created type jurisdictional issue with a very limited ability to attack it, and it sets forth in the statute how you can attack it.
What else were you going to add before Justice Green asked that question?
Oh, I was going to talk a little bit just about Bender, the case from 1990 on Bender. And just in terms of how I think if we rule this is not jurisdictional, we're essentially going to overrule Bender too, and that's why I'm going to bring it up. Bender was a case where a police officer's attorney sent in a notice, but it was within the 10 days of the notice for the notice of appeal deadline, but he failed to include in the notice of appeal one of three statutory items as to the basis of the appeal. The court ruled both that the 10 days, and then it subsequently it was pointed out to him within a few days, and he resent an amended notice that included those items. The court said both the 10-day timeline and the required provisions that have to be in that notice of appeal, both of those items were jurisdictional, so they threw his appeal out rather than having an ability to amend your pleadings, so to speak, after the 10-day timeline. And I can't really see a clear distinction then between the result in that case and the result that will occur here if this was not jurisdictional.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Layton, what about Bender? I mean, we said in 90 we required a pretty strict compliance when officers are, and we said they've really got to follow. When it says must is must, and that's jurisdictional. And is there any kind of unfairness in requiring strict compliance of officers and substantial compliance for cities, or does Bender sort of give way after Dubai?
I think Bender is distinguishable. I do not believe it gives way, and I do not believe that if the court were to rule the way we're asking the court to rule, that it would overrule Bender. And if you're looking at it from a fairness perspective and you make a certain persuasive argument, well, the officer has to do more or has to comply in a stricter way than the city does, then that might seem unfair. But I think the legal distinction here that's critical is that in Bender and in subsequent case law, the court was analyzing the officer's notice of appeal to a decision maker, to the commission or the examiner in that case. And the court held that notice of appeal conferred jurisdiction, much like under the rules of appellate procedure, the notice of appeal that a litigant files with the trial court is what confers jurisdiction on the appellate court, and then the same with respect to the Supreme Court. We're not dealing with that type of issue here. What we're dealing with in cases like the case at bar is whether or not a notice letter sent to the officer complied with the procedural requirements set forth in the statute. The notice letter that's in the record, you'll see, is countless pages long. I would estimate at least 10 pages long, and includes everything else required by this statute, which is quite lengthy, but for, unfortunately, the provision in question. By my count, the city included 8 of the 9 procedural requirements. And while this statute says for each one of them that the notice must, the word must is used repeatedly, this court has repeatedly held there's no question that while must creates a condition precedent and is mandatory, that the word alone does not make the issue jurisdictional. We do have to look again at the legislative intent here. The legislative intent was certainly to give a meaningful review.
But you would agree that this is a bit of an unusual situation because of the limited appellate rights. There would be no mechanism to enforce the legislature's clear mandate.
I do agree that makes the consequences more complicated. Absolutely. I don't agree that foregoes any type of remedy.
So if the chief didn't put reasons in, if they only hit one of the requirements, then there'd be no way to enforce that statute because of the limited right of appeal.
Well, the reasons, first of all, are different. The statute specifically allows that with respect to a more serious case, like a case of suspension, failure to adequately give notice of the reasons of discipline results in automatic reinstatement, and it does divest the hearing examiner of jurisdiction or the commission of jurisdiction, so that is distinguishable. However, what the statute does not speak to is whether or not there is any type of additional administrative remedy allowed. And I think Justice Wainwright, when he pointed out that when considering jurisdiction, you're not considering remedies. And in this case, the officer is trying to hide behind the jurisdictional argument.
Well, you say, and there's a counter to this argument. You say the hearing officer offered to abate the proceeding so that the notice could be cured, but the respondent says, well, his 10 days had already run. There's no way that abatement would have had any positive impact on his appellate rights or his choices. How do you answer that?
Well, the hearing examiner offered to allow the claimant to change his election.
How could he change his election when the 10 days were done?
There's nothing that disallows the examiner from suspending that. The court has held that the examiners have a lot of authority.
Well, the statute says you've got to appeal to the commission or the hearing examiner in 10 days. So the hearing examiner, and you all can all agree, okay, you can go back and go to the commission, but what's the commission going to do? They're going to say this is late.
They're going to say it's jurisdictional.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I believe they'd be wrong if they did, Justice O'Neill. I also believe that these type of remedies, I mean, the court has included these type of remedies before, like in Lautenheiser, letting the litigant there go back before the commissioner's court. We have the issues with the Flack of giving notice under the Texas Tort Claims Act, and the court has also allowed the litigant in those cases to go back and cure that. So while I think
the legislature fairly quickly said, nope, that's jurisdictional.
Well, and that's a good point, Justice Wainwright, because there the legislature clarified its intent. Here the legislative intent that we have in the statute does not include a jurisdictional mandate at all. So with
actually, it doesn't include any remedy, as you pointed out, for failure to comply.
That is correct.
So if we cut right to the chase, the options are create a remedy or let jurisdiction be the remedy.
And I think that while... Yes, and if I could just say in 15 seconds briefly, if the court would indulge me, I think that that's true. It's important to remember when dealing with this remedy conundrum that we also have to look at the public versus legislative purposes. Public outweighs under the Code Construction Act, and this would allow no meaningful review of a potentially rogue officer, which goes against the legislative intent as expressed in the legislative history. Thank you.
Thank you. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.